Welcome to the Science and Cocktails podcast.
Get on your spaceship.
Interesting.
And now the machine is working.
Increase the frequency of lucid dreams in our laboratories.
Over time, the variation within a group becomes variation between groups.
It has to do with particles or objects and how they move.
Am I true? Am I awake?
We think that there is a kind of God against it.
What are the processes behind?
It's a piece of stuff.
We are moving in space-time. All of us go like 1 second per second, flowing up in the fourth dimension.
Brazilian officials have told the BBC that there's been an aggressive increase in deforestation since the election of President Bolsonaro in January. An area of Amazon rainforest roughly the size of a football pitch is now being cleared every minute.
Firefighters, no match for flames this ferocious and this intense.
That crypto fire igniting palm trees here on the Bolivian-Brazilian border, fueled by wind, the flames leaping across the dry brush.
Whole mountains, hills, and valleys engulfed in smoke.
This is one of the 80,000 fires that have burned in Brazil this year.
Right now, the Amazon rainforest is being consumed by fire.
The deforestation in the Amazon has been a lot in the media the last year, as the fires has been intensifying.
In fact, there's an 80% increase in fires just over the last year alone.
I'm Sophie Hjort, and this episode is about deforestation. Global deforestation has been an issue of public concern for decades, but still the primary forest areas are decreasing every year. Not only are the primary forests storing enormous amounts of carbon dioxide, but it is also the home of about 80% of all species of plants and animals, which is in great danger of extinction. It is estimated that about 4,000 to 6,000 rainforest species go extinct every year. Tropical forests like rainforests are unique ecosystems in a delicate balance. And if a larger part of the forest is destroyed, the balance can be tipped, resulting in the whole forest area turning into savanna. This episode of the Science and Cocktails podcast will take a look at the global picture of forest covers and zoom into what drives the deforestation and how it can be stopped. We start with the great perspectives, looking at the Earth from space. Rasmus Fenstolt is a professor at the Department of Geosciences and Natural Resource Management at University of Copenhagen.
I have been teaching and doing research in the use of remote sensing data for solving all kinds of various challenges related to how we manage our global environmental resources and also how climate change impact on those resources.
Today, what is the status quo on the global deforestation? Is it decreasing or is it increasing? And how fast is it going?
It varies a lot from region to region. So the overall perception has been that at the global scale, global forest resources have been declining over the recent 20, 30 years. Maybe I should say that the type of remote sensing data that we have from where we can do these kind of time series analysis to look at changes over time, they cover something like 30 to 40 years by now, depending on what type of data we are talking about. So over this period, many studies has pointed towards the fact that there has been a decrease in global forest cover, but more recent studies has tried to nuance this a little bit and has shown actually that there's quite big differences. For instance, in the tropical regions, we have continued ongoing deforestation being the major sign from those images. But on the other hand, if we look at the more higher latitudes on the northern hemisphere, these so-called boreal forest areas, it seems like the global warming has actually contributed significantly to an increase in woody cover in those areas.
And why is that?
It's primarily because trees at our latitudes in Denmark and at higher latitudes in Russia in particular, but also in Canada, for instance, that global warming combined with the also increased CO2 in the atmosphere actually benefit tree growth in those areas.
So in the north, forest covers are increasing due to the climate change factors like temperatures and increased carbon dioxide in the air. So it can be seen as some kind of nature regulation of climate change, where the trees are absorbing some of the accumulated carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. But what about the forests in the tropical areas?
In those areas, then, it's a very mixed bag, I would say, whether there has been increases or decreases in woody vegetation. Some of the studies that we have done from remote sensing actually points towards the fact that in developing countries like sub-Saharan Africa, there has been an increase in the woody cover over the last decades, which comes as a surprise to many because these are the areas where we are used to think of an increasing population causing an increase in the pressure on resources, etc. But from the analysis that we have done, we can see that the local population in those areas they clearly recognize the importance of those trees and they maintain a woody cover in those areas.
Do they maintain the natural forest or do they plant trees for agriculture or like commercial benefits?
It's primarily the latter, I would say. In sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, they have what is called parkland. Parklands, it's a livelihood system where farmers used to preserve a certain percentage of trees on the fields because those trees are known to be beneficial for a number of different purposes. They suck up nutrients and water from deeper levels in the soil and they create some shading and they have a lot of good or beneficial purposes for agricultural growth. So in those areas, there's this practice, agroforestry practice, as it's called, where it's a mixture of crops and trees. And in those areas, we can see that there's definitely no signs of a decrease in woody cover over the last 10, 20 years.
Okay, and where is these areas?
It's a region which is traditionally referred to as the Sahelian region, the Sahel, which spans from West Africa towards the Atlantic Ocean, towards the East Coast in East Africa, south of Sahara.
And are there other tropical regions where you see a larger decrease in the forest cover?
Yeah, depending on what period we are talking about, but many of us who are now, let's say, between 30 and 50 years old, we have heard a lot about deforestation in the tropics, in the tropical rainforest, for decades that has been going on. And this is in many areas still the case. In the Amazon, for instance, with the political environment in Brazil, the deforestation is still ongoing, sadly.
Even though forests are expanding in the northern parts of the globe, despite decades of attention on the importance of reducing deforestation, the tropical forests are still decreasing. tropical forest has a much higher storage capacity than other types of forests. Therefore, tropical forest conservation is a very effective way to keep greenhouse gas emission down. When the rainforests are destroyed or burned, carbon dioxide, which has been stored in the forest, is released into the atmosphere. Between 10 and 15% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions are due to deforestation. The uptake of carbon from the atmosphere by tropical forests peaked in the 1990s, when it removed from the air about 17% of carbon dioxide emission from human activities. But the last decade, the amount has sunk to about 6% of the global emission. And the difference is about the same as the decade of fossil fuel emission from UK, Germany, France and Canada put together. I met Tilde Bech-Bruun, lecturer at the Department of Geosciences and Natural Resource Management at the University of Copenhagen, for a walk under the trees in a park in Copenhagen, to talk about what drives deforestation, which initiatives are made to stop it, and what are the issues and dilemmas associated with that.
There are three main commodities that bear a lot of the responsibility for deforestation. They are soy and beef and palm oil. They are the three big drivers. So together, these three crops, they account for about 60% of the global deforestation. So that's quite a lot. In addition to that, there's timber extraction too. So also a commodity, but not in relation to agriculture.
But timber for production of furniture or...
For example, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Everything. Houses, buildings, furniture, whatever.
Okay. And is that especially because some of the trees are very hard wood trees and very valuable trees sort?
Yeah, it is. So a lot of the most valuable tree sorts are found in tropical rainforests. So they are... Yeah, extracted from there and contributing to deforestation there. That is particular in Africa. That's one of the main drivers, or one of the big drivers. Whereas if you look at South America, we're talking about soy and beef as the two most important ones. And in Southeast Asia, it's palm oil.
Okay.
So you can kind of, yeah, that's how they distribute.
And which international initiatives are made to stop the deforestation around the world?
Yeah. So the most, the largest one, if you will, is the RED program. RED is a United Nations initiative, and RED is short for Reduced Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation. So basically, it's a program that aims at compensating or paying for avoided deforestation by paying countries for curbing the deforestation rates. That's the master idea of the RED program. Okay, so there are two different legs or branches of RED. There's the big one that I just talked about, and then there's a smaller one that is used for carbon offsetting. So that is used by companies, for example, to compensate for their carbon emissions by protecting forest through the RED program. So two different types.
Can you describe how are they doing that?
So carbon, trees are storing carbon, right? And quite a lot of it, especially in the tropics. Well, for example, if an aviation company, just for as an example, but a very realistic example, if an aviation company wants to give the customers the opportunity of offsetting their carbon emissions from flying, then they can pay for forest protection in an area in the tropics. And then the carbon stored in that area and accumulated over time will offset the emissions.
Okay. And who is keeping track of those things?
Yeah, there's some standards that these programs, these projects have to live up to. And then there are companies that are authorized to verify the build-up of carbon stocks, or the carbon stored in these projects. So that's something called the verified carbon standards. They have to follow certain criteria and measure in certain ways. So it's a third party verification, so to say. It's not the company itself.
Okay.
So that there are a lot of practices in place to verify that. Which, so this being said, they are in place. But as a researcher, I know that it's extremely difficult to actually measure or to actually know how much carbon is stored in these systems. There are a lot of uncertainties in this verification, but that's how it is at the moment.
And the forest that they protect, is that only original forest, or can a company also say we're going to plant a certain amount of trees to compensate for our carbon emission?
They can, but then it's a part of another program. Then it's not a part of the RED program. If they want to plant trees, then it's a part of the so-called CDM program, which is another international mechanism. It's short for the Clean Development Mechanism. So then it won't be original forest, as the RED program is technically supposed to target. However, there's a problem associated with calling forest original. There's actually a problem associated with calling anything a forest, if you want to get into that. There are more than 800 definitions of what a forest is. So that's one of the larger, I would say, challenges in developing programs to protect forests. So, for example, if you ask FAO, the Food and Agricultural Organization, they will define a forest as an area that has, I think it's 10% tree cover, which is not a lot. It's less than in my garden, for example. So 10% tree cover has to cover a certain area. They also include industrial tree plantations, so not original forest, the kind of forest that normal people perceive as a forest. So industrial plantations that are planted with the purpose of extracting wood products. So not oil palm plantations, because you are extracting a crop. But for example, acacia plantations to produce or to extract wood would under this definition be a forest, whereas an oil palm plantation or a rubber plantation will not. They also define if you cut down an area with the intention of replanting this area with trees, it's still a forest.
So a company could say, I'm protecting this acacia plantation. And that is compensating for my carbon emissions.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
But still I'm cutting down the trees and selling them but planting new trees.
Yeah.
Okay.
You could say that. But then of course the carbon stored in the plantation would have to balance whatever you're cutting down. There would have to be an argument for storage. But the quality, so to say, of the forest is not necessarily in question. But different so this was just the FAO definition, which is being used by some, but many countries have their own definition, which is like there's a gradient of what different countries accept as a forest. But for the international agreements, of course, it's a challenge that it's not necessarily clear what we are talking about, and it's often a matter of negotiation what a real forest is or what an original forest is.
So in the RED programs, there's not a particular definition for a forest?
No, it was discussed at great length at some of the COP meetings at the RED negotiations, and finally it was decided to leave it up to the individual countries to define what a forest is in that specific context. So yeah, no.
So you already mentioned that the definition of what is a forest is a problem in those initiatives like RED, but what other dilemmas and conflicts are involved when protecting a forest?
Yeah. Okay, so often indigenous forest-dependent communities, they are relying on communal rights for the forest, so traditional rights as opposed to formal land titles. They often don't have land title rights or land titles for the forest that they're depending on. So then when the RED program was introduced, these forests suddenly became very interesting for local governments, for example, or for large-scale companies. And since the indigenous communities don't have these formal rights to the land, this land has become contested, making these indigenous communities quite vulnerable for land grabbing. And that has been one of the major conflicts in relation to RED. Instances of indigenous communities feeling that their that their forest has been just claimed by other agents, other actors.
So because of those programs like RED, the other agents has seen that now they have an interest in buying or owning this forest,
yeah.
So they can say that we're protecting this
exactly.
forest.
Exactly. Sorry, yeah. So they can get RED compensation for protecting this forest, exactly. While the original idea of RED was, at least as I perceived the original idea of RED, the idea would be to compensate the indigenous communities depending on the forest. And that's also the general idea, but in many cases that hasn't happened, or that has been one of the big challenges, at least.
There live approximately 260 million people in the world's rainforests. The forest people are fully or partly dependent on the resources that the forest provides them, such as water, food, fuel, and medicine. At least 60 million of the people who live in the rainforest are indigenous people, who often have their own culture, which stands out from the rest of the population. And in many countries, the people dependent on the forests are minorities who are suppressed by the majority population. Lack of equal access to influence the political decision-making processes and underrepresentation in the political institutions gives them therefore limited possibilities to influence policies affecting their livelihood. And though they are not the main drivers of the deforestation, the initiatives to protect their forests often affects their livelihood by limiting their access to the forest resources. The indigenous people in the tropical forests have often cultivated the land as slash and burn agriculture for thousands of years. Because the soil is poor in tropical rainforests, where the nutrients are held mostly in the trees, it is a sustainable method of farming. Small areas of bush or forest are cleared and the smaller trees burned. This unlocks the nutrients in the vegetation and gives the soil fertilizer that is easily taken up by plants. A few years later, the soil is degraded and the farmer moves on and do the same at another site. The original ground is left fallow for up to 20 years so that the forest can regenerate. Slash and burn agriculture is often forbidden in protected forest, and it is often preserved by the governments as an ineffective and primitive use of the land. With increasing deforestation in the rainforest for farming land to produce food, a large area of the tropical forest is cleared for monoculture, and the ground is not left fallow for the forest to generate. Because of the limited amount of nutrients in the soil in the rainforest, the soil soon becomes less and less fertile. And if only one crop is grown on the ground, which is mostly the case, it will be further exhausted. After quite a few years, the land is so exhausted that the farmers once again have to move, clear the forest elsewhere, and start all over again. And in this way, the modern farmers move further and further into the rainforest, leaving a cleared and exhausted ground behind.
Then another challenge also related to indigenous communities is that even if the rights of this indigenous forest-dependent community, even if the rights are recognized and they are eligible for RED compensation, then not everyone in an indigenous community are equally depending on the forest, right? There will often be people that are much more dependent on the forest, and these people will often be the poorest people within the community. While the people who are not dependent on the forest will often be the more powerful people, so the elite, if you wish, within the community. And these people will normally be the people who are negotiating the compensation. So getting the compensation to, or getting making sure that the right people are compensated is a challenge. You risk exacerbating the internal differences within the community, or creating conflicts within the communities when introducing a RED program. Project.
Okay, so the indigenous people, they are supposed to get financially compensation, so they should get some money because they cannot go and and cut down the trees anymore, or how is it in practice that they're compensated?
Yeah, it depends on the context. It also depends on what they're actually using the forest for. So often they want, I'm saying often a lot, it's really context dependent what people are using it for, but it could be for collecting the so-called non-timber forest products, such as going to collect bamboo shoots in Asia, or mushrooms, or firewood, or it could be cutting down trees also, but it depends on what they're using it for. But the idea, yes, is that they should have some kind of compensation, but not necessarily monetary compensation. It could also be developing infrastructure in the community, for example, building a school, or it could be other kinds of compensation, which is also tricky to make everyone happy.
Does anyone know how successful the RED program is in actually compensating the local people in the areas who are dependent on the forest?
That's a good question. I don't think anyone knows, but this exact issue has been one of the major points of critique of the RED program. So I think the general perception is that it has not been successful in getting the compensation money to the local communities who have lost access to the forest that they have depended on or are depending.
Do you think it's possible to include both protecting the original forest and the livelihood of the indigenous people?
Well, yeah, I definitely think it's possible. One reason is actually that often the indigenous people are not really the ones responsible for the deforestation as such. So that's relatively easy to solve in some cases. And then I think that if we get more focus on indigenous people's rights and really start taking it seriously and paying attention to it in the programs, making sure that people are heard, I think it's possible. It's actually already written into the so-called RED safeguards that everyone has to be heard and indigenous people's rights can't be violated or shouldn't be violated. It's just not really put in practice. But I think it's possible, but it will require work and change of mentalities in some contexts also to actually take this seriously. And yes, I think it's possible, but at the moment, indigenous people, the indigenous people's organizations are certainly not happy with RED as it is now. So something has to happen for this to actually work, but it should be possible.
Isn't one of the reasons also that in many countries there is like a certain discrimination
exactly.
already against the indigenous people,
yeah.
so they already
yeah.
are not heard in the public or
yeah.
like their rights are not taken so serious.
Exactly, that's one of the extreme challenges at the moment, but also something that ideally that the RED program could actually make a positive, have a positive influence on. So, but yes, it's really complicated in many countries. So in some countries, indigenous people are not even recognized as citizens, right? With rights. So many, many challenges. Yes, and but still, I would say it should be possible in many cases. Yeah.
And what about protecting the forest? Is that successful?
It depends on who you ask, I guess. But compared to how much money has been spent in the RED program until now, I think the answer is no. It hasn't really paid off in terms of avoided deforestation. You can't argue. There's no proof that it has curbed deforestation rates in the tropics. You can argue that the RED money has created a lot of attention on the issue. There's a lot of talk about deforestation at the moment. There's a lot of attention towards indigenous people's rights. Indigenous people's rights being violated in relation to RED, but also it's really on the agenda now. So you could say that is actually something that we are talking about it and developing initiatives or developing methods to try to target it or try to solve it. So things are happening, but think that very few people would argue that RED is a success as it stands now. I definitely wouldn't. One of the challenges is permanence of the forest, the permanence of the forest that RED is supposed to save. There's a a compelling example from Brazil, for example, that received red money for avoided deforestation, based on avoided deforestation in 2014, I think. They received money quite recently, while at the same time we are seeing the deforestation rates in Brazil accelerating rapidly at the moment.
That there's been an aggressive increase in deforestation.
The Amazon rainforest is on fire again. The 80,000 fires that have burned in Brazil this year.
Right now, the Amazon rainforest is being consumed by fire.
In 2020, the burning Amazon has been in the news, and we have seen satellite photos of South America with red and orange areas all over the Amazons, showing the intensifying fires. Those satellite photos are part of the data Rasmus Finstholz is analyzing to follow the development of the global forest cover.
It is unfortunately intensifying. This is what we can see from space. And it is very unfortunate that in Brazil, actually the major deforestation that went on in the 80s and 90s was actually halted at the turn of the new millennium and up till 2010. But the last 5 years, it has changed dramatically again due to the political situation in Brazil. So there are massive deforestation going on, and this is despite that in Brazil, actually, the Brazilian space agency, it's called INPE. It's one of the biggest agencies that we have at the global scale dealing with the remote sensing and doing remote sensing analysis. And they constantly produce results supporting that things are moving in the wrong direction. But this information is literally suppressed by the sitting president in Brazil. A new initiative hopefully can shed even some more global focus on this. It's actually an initiative which is sponsored by Norway. The Norwegian government has bought a huge amount of otherwise commercial data which is something that comes with a cost to be able to analyze. They have bought for free global coverage of the tropics from a new type of satellite data where we are able to see many more details as compared to the traditional images that we have free of charge. So hopefully this new resource available to us remote sensing scientists will make it easier for us to produce very accurate assessment of what's going on, and hopefully also by the fact that those data has now been made free, there will be an even increased focus at the global scale, because I'm sure that many, many people around the world will dive into those data to see how they can be used for the situation in the Amazon.
What kind of data is it?
Yeah, it's a type of data. If we talk a little bit on the technical side here, it's a kind of new paradigm within remote sensing, because we are used to use satellite data coming from kind of individual platforms orbiting the Earth. And having individual satellites orbiting the Earth allows us to get, let's say for a case of Amazon, allows us to get a good image, let's say once every second week, something like that. This has been the traditional situation. If we want images with a relatively high spatial resolution where it's easier to map deforestation and to some extent forest degradation. But more recently, there has been on the commercial side, there has been a production or a shift towards the production of so-called microsatellites. So instead of having one satellite, now there are hundreds of small satellites orbiting the Earth at the same time. And this means that we can have the same type of high spatial resolution data where we can see a lot of details, but we can also have such type of data every single day instead of several weeks in between. And this is important because if you consider an area like the Amazon, for instance, everybody knows that it rains a lot in Amazon and there's a lot of clouds. And this also means that even though you potentially would have an image every second week, maybe this information is not really useful because it was cloudy during that particular time where the satellite passed by. And we often see that when we look at the image archives, it can actually take several years before we get a good cloud-free scene based on those traditional images where we would have one image every second week. So this change towards having satellites orbiting every day hopefully will allow us to get much more useful information from those cloud prune areas of the tropics.
And you look into those data, I guess, as well.
Yes, we look into those data by now. And this by itself puts us in a new situation, new challenging situations, because this is massive amounts of data. And we need now to collaborate strongly with computer scientists that are better able to handle such massive amounts of data in a smart way, and also to produce algorithms that can analyze those data in smart ways. This really puts challenges to how to be able to handle such amount of data. So currently in Denmark, University of Copenhagen, but also I recently spoke to colleagues in Germany, in Berlin, they're in the same situation, and in US, we are all, us as environmental scientists, we are all in the same situation where we should really look towards building synergies between different research fields towards computer science to deal with this new challenge.
Hopefully the massive amount of data bought and released by Norway will put an even bigger pressure to protect the Amazon, which is crucial for the whole global ecosystem. Because if the deforestation in Amazon is not stopped, it might soon reach a tipping point where the whole ecosystem of the forest will go through an irreversible change. And enormous amounts of carbon dioxide will be released into the atmosphere. There are several stress factors that seems to be on the way to push the system towards a tipping point. A rainforest is characterized by regulating the local climate by recycling water. When it rains in the Amazon, most of the moisture is returned to the atmosphere through evaporation. The transpiration of the moisture from plant leaves transfer water from the soil into the atmosphere. These processes keeps the atmosphere moist, but also help drive the convection, a strong upward motion of the air, which ultimately creates clouds and more rainfall. Either reducing the rainfall or the amount of forest can shift the climate into a drier state that cannot support a rainforest. There are three potential causes for this. The first is a decline in rainfall in response to the warming climate. The second is a response to reducing transpiration in response to a higher concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which results in the plants to leave their microscopic pores for absorbing carbon dioxide less widely open, so the plants lose less transpiration, means less water going back to the atmosphere. Finally, the third and most likely the most important is the direct impact of deforestation. Fewer trees means less evaporation and less moisture entering the atmosphere, which again means less rainfall. All of these things are resolving in a drier Amazon, and there's a limit for how much drier it can get before it can no longer support itself. Beyond this point, the forest would see widespread dieback and transition into savanna. Thank you. Though deforestation seems far away from many of us, and even thinking of it makes us feel powerless, that it is out of our hands to stop it. But our actions have an incredible large impact on tropical deforestation. Not referring to climate activism, but to our everyday consumerism. Many of the products we bring home from the supermarkets are directly or indirectly contributing to deforestation.
If the consumers stops eating meat, for example, or reduce the meat consumption, it's probably more realistic. But dietary changes to reduce the demand for these products, especially beef and also soy, which is mainly used for animal feed. So dietary change, large-scale dietary change towards reduced meat consumption.
So which structural changes needs to be made to protect the original forest around the world?
Yeah. So that dietary change, but also developing an international framework for forest governance would be great. Would be very meaningful. So a policy framework with binding commitments in relation to forest governance, or with real sanctions. Governments or nations don't comply with those commitments, then real serious sanctions built into the framework. That would also be that would be very helpful. Maybe not so realistic if we look at how it's going with the United Nations Framework Convention for Climate Change, where nations are very reluctant to engage in binding commitments and there are no sanctions. But nevertheless, it would be very meaningful in relation to deforestation too. And another structural change would be to take deforestation more serious in trade agreements, for example. So instead of just writing deforestation commitments or anti-deforestation commitments into trade agreements, then actually taking it seriously and associating it with sanctions if nations are not complying to those commitments. That would be leveled down from an international framework, right? So
yeah.
Bilateral trade agreements. Then also if we accept the premise of using market forces to try to combat deforestation as we partly do in RED, if we accept that, then putting a cap on the carbon emissions would make a lot of sense, because as it is now, there is no cap, right? Everything is voluntary. People are companies are using offsetting as a part of their CSR strategies, but there are no real limits to how much you can emit. If there was a limit, then the carbon price would increase, and then suddenly there would be a lot more money in the system. And that was actually the assumption when RED was developed, that there would be a cap, so that the CO2 price or the carbon price would increase, and there would be a lot more money to use for combating deforestation. So that would be another.
And why hasn't that been made? Why isn't there a cap?
Yeah, there are a lot of economic interests and extremely powerful actors who have a lot of saying in this kind of international policies. I think that's the simple answer. There are many different interests, and some are more powerful than others.
So in general, how positive are you? Do you think we'll manage to protect some of the forest, or do you think we'll see a future with no forest at all?
Yeah. So in spite of what I've said until now, I'm actually quite positive. So, and maybe it's more about my own personality than about what research shows. But I just can't believe that we will destroy all the forest. I don't want to believe it, and I don't think it will happen. But I do think that maybe it will take some a really serious event, deforestation-wise. Like for example, dieback of the Amazon. We're currently probably pushing the Amazon towards a tipping point where it will turn into savanna because of deforestation and climate change. But it is likely. That the hydrological circle in the Amazon could break down and decrease the precipitation so much that it would turn into a savanna, and something like that, like something really large scale, serious breakdown of an iconic forest ecosystem, that maybe what it takes to wake up and realize that we have to stop or have to make some radical changes. But I do think that there are a lot of initiatives pointing in the right direction at the moment. So that also makes me positive.
Oh, it's really sad. It's really sad, and it makes you feel so there's nothing really we can do. But there is. Yeah, that was my last question. What can we do as normal consumers?
Yeah. So, with the risk of sounding a bit cliché, consumers are a big part of the problem. So obviously, we are also a big part of the solution. So changing consumption patterns away from meat, and away from meat, and also demanding deforestation-free products to a larger extent than we are doing now would certainly help. So there's quite a lot of certification schemes targeting deforestation. There's the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, Roundtable on Sustainable Soy, there's the FSC wood certification program. So demanding, pushing for this kind of products would certainly also be helpful to combat deforestation. It does make a difference what we do and what we demand as consumers. It does. So can I use an example from Denmark?
Yes. Yeah.
So that's an example from Denmark where we are producing a lot of pork meat, and we are using soy, a lot of soy to feed this pig population, and a lot of the soy is imported from South America. There was a recent study, I think it was by WWF. So the study showed that if we changed the normally or the conventionally produced soy to deforestation certified deforestation free soy, the price of 1 kilo of pork meat would increase by a quarter of a cent, a euro cent. And still there was a great resistance against this from the Danish agricultural organizations. But as consumers, I think it would be fairly easy to push towards such a change, which would actually make a big difference in the producing countries.
On that small slice of hope, this episode will end. Thanks for listening to the Science and Cocktails podcast, which was funded by the Novo Nordisk Foundation and produced by me, Sophie Hjort, for the Science and Cocktails Foundation. The music is originally composed by Hjelte Bisted Müller, also known as Trommelorkestret. Find future episodes on scienceandcocktails.org or where you find your podcasts.